I'm attending a lot of conferences right now, also from an insurance innovation perspective, right? BI is completely, it's almost like this exposure doesn't exist. If you talk to your clients, it's quite the opposite. It's one of those exposures which constantly appear on the top 10 in the risk assessments, where clients ask what keeps you awake at night. It's BI. And I don't really see an awful lot of development in that respect. Also, equally, I don't really see an awful lot of development from a technological perspective, how to assess these type of exposures. And when you think about it, right, I think it's perfectly doable.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cyber Insurance Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Hess. Stay tuned.
Hartmut, it's great to see you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, so thank you very much for having me, right? I'm really looking forward to our chat, Anthony.
Yeah, it's been great to meet you and talk with you so far. I think I like to kick off with just introductions. What could you tell our audience about yourself and the company you work for?
Yeah, maybe just quickly. My name is Hartmut Mai, and I'm the group president of CyberRight. CyberRight is actually a company which focuses on cyber insurance risk analytics. So we provide a single risk profiling for targeted accounts from brokers or insurance companies, or actually batch profiling of large portfolios, such as for large reinsurance organizations for their respective cyber portfolios. So that's what we do. So me as a person, right? So it's, before I started work for CyberRight, I was 14 years with Allianz and spent 8 years there on the board as chief underwriting officer, and then another 1.5 years as the chief regions and markets officer. And prior to that, I've been building the global financial lines unit for Allianz. Prior to Allianz, I worked for 2 years at Marsh and FinPro. And prior to that, I had 12 years at AIG, where I spent the final 3 years running the D&O region in the UK, overlooking the region for UK, Ireland, Africa, and MEPSA. So, and I'm a lawyer by training, so it's studied law.
Really, really interesting background. Thanks for that. I think just kind of looking across your long history in the cyber market and insurance, I thought maybe we could start by kind of talking about that and, you know, how's the history kind of progress into today, and then where do you see things going?
That's really interesting, right? Because when you look into the cyber line of business as we look at it today, right, it's there is a this line of business went through an evolution, right? So it's not necessarily a new risk which was seeking insurance, because this risk was insured before, under other insurance programs, and sometimes in property, sometimes in embedded in liability policies, or in Germany, big in engineering policies such as electronic versicherung, so electronic insurance. So that kind of product existed quite for some time already out there. But at a certain point, when these attacks were actually creeping up and it became a real issue, a real problem for our insureds, people had the feeling that we should actually spend a little bit more focus on this line of business, i.e. build a standalone program for it. And that that happened in the year of 2010-ish. When I was actually at Allianz, I released the first standalone policy for Europe in 2012. And that was a big thing for Allianz at the time. And and a lot of try and error, because when you want to start a new line of business, you obviously actually have to have a wording which is fine. You can actually always design something as a lawyer, right? It's not really a big thing to write a form. But then the actuary is actually have a look at you and basically say, how are you going to price this risk? And usually, right, you have a lot of data in the back room in terms of losses, or you can actually, if you don't have direct data, there is some data you can refer to from other lines of business. But in cyber, we were pretty much dry in that respect. It felt like a try and error approach if it came to pricing. Okay. And that was actually one big challenge. And the other challenge was actually that you don't know how the clients would react to it, right? So there was a big discussion on forms initially, on underwriting approach, and then definitely on limits as well, right? When we approached first the market with a limit of 20 million, always thought that this could be actually leading capacity where other carriers would actually step in and in order to build a significant tower for a company. But the first feedback we actually received from clients was, with 20 million, honestly, guys, this is not a drop in the bucket for us, right? It is a drop in the bucket for us. So that really doesn't cover what we need. And then slowly but surely, we've been building, right, lines of business, and with the use of reinsurance, and we built it out to at that time to roughly 100 million limit, which is today, in today's world, this is completely unheard of. And then clients did still not buy it because then it was actually too expensive for them. So it's I think, when you look back, I think it is a line of business which was in its infancies and which is maturing still today. But it's maturing at a speed which we've never seen in any other line of business. And I think this is very important if you look into this kind of development, right? So it's and also the latest development, right? Data, there's a lot of data. I mean, our company CyberRight is actually big in providing this data to the insurance industry and also the analytics thereof, especially in those areas where there's simply not enough data. I'm speaking about SME and mid-corp segments. But when there's one challenge from the past is then solved, and the next challenge actually then pops up, and I'm pretty sure we'll be talking about these next challenges in this podcast. But it is a line of business which is maturing very fast at lightning speed compared to others. And we just simply actually have to go through the process. And if you look back, it's actually a good process. I'm very positive on that.
So what do you think kind of the speed it's changing and kind of where you see things today? Like what's the opportunity? Like where do you see things kind of going in the near term?
If you look into cyber, right, and I said as a line of business, and I said it before, right, it's maturing very fast. It's not only maturing very fast, it's growing very fast. We're looking at a line of business which is in premium numbers on a global scale is roughly between 12 and 13 billion. I think this is what the latest estimates say. And there are also some estimates who actually see this market in 7 years from now, in 2030, at somewhere 50 billion. There are a few numbers out there, and some people say it's 80 billion. It doesn't really matter, right, which number you would actually follow, whether it's 50 or 80. It is a staggering number. And if you look into this line of business, generating a growth of 25%+ CAGR, you got to ask yourself whether there are enough resources in the market currently to actually keep this growth happening. And when I'm saying resources, I mean two things. I mean capital, and I mean right now, well, I shouldn't say people, because I should say underwriting capacity, which doesn't necessarily have to be people. And if you look into the population of underwriters in today's world, right, most of them do actually come out of tech PI, PI, DNO. It's all financial lines guys mm-hmm. who are actually doing the cyber underwriting right now. Very few of the underwriters do actually have a specific and detailed education in cyber security or cyber insurance risk. And if that growth is going to happen as it is predicted, you know, that shortage of available insight and that available knowledge, right, will only be much bigger. And that's why I think, you know, you got to focus on ways to make the current underwriters in the field much more efficient by the use of machines, machine learning, AI, et cetera. We talked about that. And this is something what CyberWrite actually does. And I think we see a big trend in that respect, that the line of business is really maturing in that respect as well, that underwriters are seeking support from tools which are available in the market.
Yeah, it's interesting just kind of looking at, there are a lot of parallels. You know, you kind of look at cyber underwriters, and I think, I'm not quite sure on this, but I think it's under 10,000. I think, you know, dedicated cyber underwriters maybe in the world, it feels like it's in the thousands. There's a, you know, a bit more than that in terms of people that are dedicated to be cyber response professionals, but it's kind of the same trend. You see this massive skyrocketing, you know, demand for cybersecurity knowledge on the underwriting side or cyber underwriting capability. But it's the same for us. It's the same on the cyber response side. What could we automate and how can we automate it? What will AI do? You know, how can it make us all a lot more efficient? Because there's just not the people with the skill sets. So
yeah, exactly right. And it's not only an efficiency game. It is also, right, I think the reflection that underwrites cyber is so complex in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, identifying risk factors and correlating them with existing claims or existing breaches. Really, you know, take a given claim into its pieces, break it up into its pieces, and then, you know, define certain risk classifiers for that with whom you will actually then train your AI engine and so forth, right? I think there's so much calculation happening in the background that this is just way too much for a human being to achieve that on their own. And I think that, you know, there is a growing interest in that respect to seek really you know, AI and machine learning tools and instruments to really support the underwriting in that respect. So it's not just the numbers, it is also mm-hmm. the complexity of the underlying risk. I guess that's what I want to say, right? Where this can really help. So it's an efficiency gain, yes, definitely, but it's also a lot more, a clearer view on the underlying exposures, especially if you think about moving from a qualitative underwriting to more quantitative underwriting, right? It's a big interest in insurance organizations to really move the underwriting bias out of the system and to base their underwriting approach more on objective data points rather than just, I'm exaggerating here, a gut feel from the given underwriter who actually just made a bad experience in a certain risk or certain jurisdiction and therefore not writing it anymore.
So it's kind of the AI and the technology and the automation, whatever's happening, you know, can bring a lot more discipline and structure and standardization to how underwriting works, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. So I guess that's kind of the people side of it. You'd also mentioned sort of the capital side of it. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, what's technology doing there? What other changes are happening there?
Again, right. So I do believe that, and this is what we hear, right? I just came back from the rendezvous meeting in Monte Carlo and this big, you know, gathering of the reinsurance market there. And what you heard there loud and clear from clients was that there's a big concern about available capital for the cyber market, right? So it's, there are some large reinsurance firms are coming already to the end of the hockey stick. I don't know whether that translates, but to the end of what is available and doable for them from a capital perspective, right? So they simply maxed out. And there's a big drive actually to look for capital outside of the insurance market and driven by the insurance market. And I think, you know, when you look into what happened, for example, in the NatCat environment, right? So it's a very similar development we've seen there for years in that space already, right? So we think about the big hurricanes and the tornadoes and the earthquakes and the wildfires and so forth, right? Based on the data which is available on these type of scenarios, right, it was insurers were, and sometimes not insurers, sometimes third-party providers were able to actually model certain type of exposures in order to give people a good understanding of a catastrophe scenario and a return period of these scenarios. And these modelings, right, helped to syndicate these type of risks into the capital markets and to trade them as cat bonds into the capital markets. And I think this would be the next thing which should be happening in cyber as well. In fact, it is happening already. We see small, I would call them test balloons. You know, some leading cyber insurers actually are in that market already and using models, finding and you know, capital in the investment community to really have a positive view on this kind of exposure. So obviously, right, there are challenges. It's, as I said, right, it's a maturing line of business and it's also maturing in that respect. But I think it's something where we as an industry, we need to have a closer look into. We as a company, we certainly do that. We look into these modeling opportunities there as well, because we heard loud and clear that there is a strong desire and a huge appetite for this in order to really further sophisticate the analytics out of a cyber insurance risk, not necessarily just from an underwriting perspective, but also from a modeling perspective. And that, I think, is very interesting.
Yeah, so I guess following that then, you know, when you look at things from a modeling perspective, you know, what issues are you seeing out there? What do you not agree with that you're seeing out there, sort of concepts that you see out there in modeling?
There's a lot of discussions on this right now. So it's, I think the biggest thing I see and I disagree with is when scenarios are discussed, which do lack a reality check. I give you one example, right? How likely is it that the Amazon cloud globally would fall out for 2 weeks?
Pretty unlikely, I would say. Not impossible, because even though it may be technically impossible, you never know. Yeah. But not very likely.
You see, right? This is actually one of the scenarios where people are looking into that, and basically what they do say is not really sure whether we're able to commit further capacity to it because the Amazon cloud could actually not service the clients anymore further, right? So it's, I think in order to make that statement, well, we can make that statement, but then you still need to think about what are you going to do with that, right? So it's you actually have to create the transparency in the existing portfolio, right? How many insurers do actually use Amazon as a cloud provider, in which territories jurisdiction? I think you should actually add a little bit more flesh to that bone. You should actually start underwriting that exposure. You should actually look, you know, the clouds are, you know, from Amazon, they are actually regionalized as well, right? Mm-hmm. You can actually take these regions and try to use that in order to create transparency in your portfolio. How many clients in my book actually use the Amazon cloud in that specific region, and just get narrower and closer also from an underwriting perspective in order to add maybe a reality check to that. Further, right, I do believe that these scenarios don't necessarily take too much into account the underlying exposures. It's very different if you look into these catastrophe modelings, look very different when you look in a purely SME-based portfolio, rather compared to a purely, a large cap-based portfolio, right? And these differences are not really taken into account if you look into the existing modeling landscape there. So when that really happens, right, when you look into an SME portfolio and you measure it against the same criteria as you would actually measure a large cap portfolio, obviously the loading on the capital side is way too high, which has a significant impact on pricing as well. And this is what we hear, this is what we see. And having said that, right, you know, since when do companies focus on the modeling side? Again, right, what I said right from the beginning, it's a very fast and rapidly maturing line of business. It is not discussed for a long time. So other lines of business, you know, have this in place since decades already.
Yeah.
And cyber is actually catching up with that in the course of, let's say, 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still a tremendous success for some companies really focus on this, to be able to already trade in the market, in the ILS and ILM market, cyber risk. But again, right, these are small test balloons and that has to be expanded, right? So it's, and therefore you need more models, you need more companies focusing on this, and you need more granularity in terms of underlying risk and so forth to make the models just more accurate.
So, you know, it sounds like maybe there just hasn't been enough focus, you know, over time on the models. Is that accurate?
Yes, I would actually say that's accurate. But there are also reasons for that, right? So mm-hmm. From a modeling perspective, somebody's got to pay these models, right? So
right.
And if there's no real readiness in order to look into that, right? And it wasn't the focus, as you said, right, mm-hmm. 5 years ago. Now it is the focus, right? And I think that market is getting ready to really support more sophistication in that respect, because it opens new avenues from a capital perspective, but also from a risk management perspective, right? It has a lot of upside for the insurance and reinsurance industry.
Yeah. Okay. I think that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, I guess just in terms of speed of change and thinking about, you know, the models and how the models have shifted and probably gotten more accurate. You know, kind of thinking through the last few years and kind of insurers not really reacting super quickly to the rise of ransomware and the kind of issues we've seen there. You know, I think, you know, I hear a lot of comments, people saying, oh, insurers didn't know what they were doing. They weren't modeling it. They didn't understand the risk, all this sort of things. I'm not quite sure. It feels like it's just changed very quickly. You know, it's not that the risk wasn't at all understood, even if the models weren't great. But I think it's kind of interesting to talk about, you know, why is it? Why is it that, you know, insurers weren't really very well prepared for the rise of ransomware? Maybe I'll put that as the question on that one.
I think, yeah, I mean, you basically said it already, right? It is a line of business, right? Where we're still learning a lot, and it's still, you know, pretty much in its infancies when you compare it to other lines of business, right? And I could actually turn that question around, and I would actually say, okay, fine. When you look into the D&O environment, right? Why wasn't anybody able to actually predict the financial market crisis?
Yeah.
Or why wasn't anybody able to actually predict what happened in Australia when that market actually turned upside down in terms of loss experience, like 3 to 5 years ago? And, you know, I think these type of scenarios, they actually do happen in fairly new lines of business, right? They don't necessarily, but they shouldn't be happening in the more mature or in the mature lines of business, but you know, there you also have your outliers, right? When you look into, I don't know, certain scenarios and catastrophe scenarios such as Fukushima as an example, right? So, you know, and the fallback industry in Thailand, when Thailand, half of Thailand was underwater and stuff, right? So it's these type of scenarios, right? Mm-hmm. It's very, very difficult to actually predict. Now, the ransom attack, I wouldn't necessarily, the pickup of the ransom attack, I wouldn't really, you know, compare that anywhere with Fukushima, right? This basically just to stress that in new lines of businesses, you can't predict any type of these developments which have never happened like that, right? So it's I agree with you, right? And you know, that was actually playing defense. Now let me play offense a bit, right? I think there was simply not enough focus, and you also saw that in the rise of the premium in this last hard market cycle for cyber. I think that the pickup and ransom attack, right, which actually made the entire line of business from a global scale unprofitable, right, that was equally used in order to make up for premium deficiencies also from a catastrophe modeling side, because there was simply no focus on that before. And funny enough, it was then used to actually make up for these type of exposures as well. And that's why the market saw these staggering price increases of sometimes 200 to 300%. And it was not just the pickup and the ransom claims experience. There were other factors driving that additionally, right? So it's thankfully, right, it seems that this development is plateauing right now. At least that's what the reports say. We've been looking into, right, when you look into the Marsh report or the Invest report, etc. So it's plateauing on a high level, right?
I think frequency is still pretty high, but the severity's gone down. I think there's probably a lot of unique challenges that were you know, particular to the first rise. And, you know, I think if it is less likely to happen again, I would say, you know, probably by a significant amount, but I'm sort of guessing, but, you know, at least
in
the same way.
But would you say the big difference, and also maybe just to add on this, right? The big difference then on ransom attacks is also that the attackers are really much more sophisticated today than they were like a year or 1.5 years ago, right? So we see this really that, you know, these black hats, they are actively using AI as well in order to make their attacks much more sophisticated. It's not this, this funny email anymore. You get, it's easy for even the non-expert to really see, there's somebody's just trying to, I don't know, use me to steal data or to wire money to some funny account and so forth, right? It is much more sophisticated today, right? So it's we really see that happening there as well. And I think it's not just the number of attacks, it's also the success rate of these attacks will go up because there's much more sophistication out there.
So I guess, you know, back to your point on the modeling, you know, it is kind of a newer thing. You know, there's not very many companies doing cyber insurance focused modeling. I thought I'd just throw it out to you. You know, what are your thoughts on that? Kind of the amount of competition or the lack of.
I think, yeah, I think you're right. And this is what I was referring to, right? When you listen to insurance and reinsurance firms, right, that there's a strong need there. And there are only basically three companies out there who are actually providing these models right now. And they differ very much to each other. And so that basically focuses companies to not only use one, they in fact use three. And they basically say it's simply not enough. Mm-hmm. And you can actually add much more sophistication to it in order to make the models, adapt to the specific portfolios of the clients as well, and to add more underwriting components to it and more risk components to it, in order to have a more accurate prediction of return periods, etc. So it's we hear that there's a strong desire for further sophistication in that respect, and I think there's room for more modeling firms out there to really have a look into that, especially those firms who are already, who already have the data in order to really do the modeling. Right? Yeah, I think there's much more room.
No, and much more room in terms of amount of sort of companies doing it, or
it's, I think yes, because only that would actually push competitive behavior, and only if there is enough competition out there, right, people would be interested to actually constantly improve their models and constantly actually seek that their clients always get best advice coming out of these models, right?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So I guess let me shift a bit. I think we've covered a lot on sort of talent, AI, capital, kind of the modeling and the modeling market. I thought it might be interesting to kind of think about what other emerging things are going on. What else would you like to talk about that's going on in the insurance market?
In the insurance market.
There are other emerging things. Sorry, I should say anything else emerging. Yeah. We'll talk about tech as well, if you want to go there.
Yes. I think that BI exposures are completely undermined in the open discussion. When you look into the big conferences and stuff like that, right? BI is never really, at least to my knowledge, right? All the conferences, I'm attending a lot of conferences right now, also from an insurance innovation perspective, right? BI is completely, it's almost like this exposure doesn't exist. If you talk to your clients, yeah, it's quite the opposite. It's one of it's one of those exposures which constantly appear on the top 10 in the risk assessments, where clients ask what keeps you awake at night. It's BI. Mm-hmm. And I don't really see an awful lot of development in that respect. Also, equally, I don't really see an awful lot of development from a technical perspective, from a technological perspective, mm-hmm. how to assess these type of exposures. And when you think about it, right, I think it's perfectly doable. In my previous job, we've been experimenting with this quite a fair bit. I think we did come a long way in order to actually have an assessment on the supply chain of a given targeted organization with publicly available information. And if you look into, large credit insurance companies and so forth, so you could actually definitely make that trading relationship from a target entity to other entities visible. And this transparency is huge if it comes to start understanding this exposure and start managing it from a broader risk management approach. It's not necessarily just insurance. It is also helping the organizations to really start managing these third-party relationships in order to get their arms around the BI exposures. Okay. But obviously, right, I think that would be an area where I think technology can really provide a lot. And unfortunately, I don't, maybe it's happening, but people don't talk about it. It's not discussed.
So it's how, what you're saying is basically how technology can be used to address third-party BI risk.
Exactly.
Is what you think people could be talking a lot more about.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess I see, you know, obviously people talk about BI, a lot about BI, and they talk a lot about third party, but it's not really the overlap of the two is what you're really saying is not enough happening.
No, how do you assess the economic impact of, let's say, a container ship blocking a canal somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you should be able to assess that in the minute it happens. For certain industry classes, for certain portfolios, or certain class perils, like, I don't know, like, see what I mean? That's what I think is should be doable today.
Okay. Cool. Interesting. I guess just in terms of your company, just in terms of CyberRight, I know we haven't been talking too much around CyberRight, but what does success look like for CyberRight?
We are successful if and when our clients who use the platform are successful. Having said that, right? So usually, you know, we believe that clients using our platform and make active use of cyber insurance risk analytics and all the services we provide on the platform, such as, for example, you know, risk mitigation recommendation and the economic impact analysis and the regulatory impact analysis, the ongoing alerting system for clients which are on the platform. So they constantly get emails alerted as soon as their risk is deteriorating. They get an alert email with the identified further vulnerabilities and potential mitigation against that. We believe that all of these services do have an impact on the existing loss ratio of portfolios. And it's not only that we think that will be the case, we know it's the case because the technology is proven. So we have carriers in the US which work on our platform, which were able to generate a record low loss ratio of 24.6% recently. And I think, you know, if these companies are successful, we are successful. And that's, I think that's the way we look at it. Obviously, right? So it's we have to generate money as well, and we have to grow as well. We have to scale and so forth, right? These are our internal challenges every other company is under, right? But you will only achieve that as soon as your platform is used to enable insurers and reinsurers to generate better results, or to help brokers and agents out there to have an educated discussion with their respective clients in order to generate more sales.
Yeah.
And provide better services to them, right?
I think the adoption of these modeling tools by brokers is an interesting trend in that regard.
Yeah, we see this. This is really, we see a big uptick in that respect. Also, smaller brokers and agents, you know, we see a big pickup in that respect in our portfolio right now. So strong interest there.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense.
Just sometimes I believe it's also, sometimes I believe it's also driven by regulation. As you know, right, mm-hmm. The SEC actually just came out with new rules, which have been discussed for 2 years now. And I think in 2023, it's going to come into effect now for public entities in the US, to really report 4 days after a significant event to the SEC, or and second, to actually, have a reporting in the 10K on measures from a risk management, broader risk management angle around cyber exposures. And I think maybe that has an impact as well, because I think brokers are then more driven to actually have these detailed discussions with their clients as well, in order to really support them in that respect. That could be.
Okay. Yeah. Kind of looking at, different companies in the kind of modeling or in the modeling space, let me just define it as that, kind of what are you seeing out there between yourselves and the other companies that are working in this area?
I think there's the big difference between us and that universe out there, right, is that there are quite a few companies focusing on cyber risk analytics. Mm-hmm. But very few of these companies are focusing on cyber insurance risk analytics. And that is a big difference. That's a huge difference. Because the way we do that, right, is that we're actually scoring not only the readiness of an organization to to see how they are protected against certain cyber vulnerabilities and cyber exposures out there. We actually also compare this targeted entity against their peers to give them a feeling, if they get a higher score, is that higher score in fact very positive, or is the benchmark showing that entire industry class is actually having a by far better score than our targeted entity, as an example, or the other way around. So that is a big difference. The second big difference is the economic impact analysis we provide to our clients. It is specific to the respective coverage sections of the policy and also in the aggregate. So underwriters would completely understand what happens if this company is attacked, and how much would it cost? And they could actually take this information and structure per deal the deal itself. They can actually see whether their limits is actually in the burning layer, or it's actually sitting in excess of that, which has an impact on pricing and underlying profitability. That would, on an aggregated basis, that could actually have an impact for large portfolios on reinsurance purchasing. And you can now actually have a much closer and more transparent assessment of certain scenarios which have an impact on your entire portfolio, which would then drive a discussion in terms of risk acceptance for this entity, and then drive also reinsurance placement accordingly. So, and before, right, there was no real crystal clear transparency around that, but this really makes it super transparent. And that's why we believe, these are just two examples. There are many more examples, but we believe, you as an insurance company, you should not only rely on third-party risk management, a cyber risk assessment. You should actually look into cyber insurance risk assessment and the analytics thereof. It makes a big difference for an insurance company.
Okay.
And there are not so many providers who do that.
Yes, right. We were definitely talking about that. So I guess just looking at the cyber world then, just current events, things in the news, what do you think is really interesting?
Well, yeah, it's obviously right. The news on MGM was interesting. You saw that, right? Everybody could read about yeah, that, right?
It's
a big one. It's also interesting, right? How the new SEC regulation, which is not yet in effect. I think it's coming into effect in December this year, but how that is actually then. then used to see how companies actually have that in the back of their mind, how they operate against that. And it's a big discussion in terms of the 4 days reporting, whether this is really possible from larger events or not, and so forth. It's, I think that actually instills a very interesting discussion. Then there's further discussion in terms of, me personally, I don't find it's so interesting, but it's necessary. Sometimes it's going a little bit too far, is actually the discussion on from the wording side, right? There's a lot of discussion on the war exclusion and a large and broader event exclusions and so forth, right? So sometimes I believe, yes, it's very important to actually drive innovation also in that respect. And but the ultimate goal must be to come to a standard, a certain operating standard for the market in terms of these type of exclusions. Why? Because I believe an exclusion should be written in a language a non-expert would be able to understand. So it must be transparent. It must be clear. And it should be very clear and completely comprehensible for the end user, i.e. the insured, what is covered and what is not covered, i.e. excluded. And my impression is that the discussion is taking that currently to a level where you're losing the audience. And where it's then in the hands of a jury to make that decision. And I think that is, to me, for an industry which lives off the trust of the customers, that is a worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. This is counterproductive, and it's not helping the market in its development, and it's not really helping clients to trust what a cyber policy can actually provide to them. And so I think that discussion hopefully will come. I'm not naive, right? We won't have one war exclusion out there as a market standard, right? But at least there are some significant developments out there where people are really trying to actually go for it, right? It's the development coming out of Lloyd's, you know, big support from large reinsurance carriers such as Munich Re for this. And they, you know, everybody actually has the same goal to really make sure that this young cyber market, which is still in its infancy, right, is going to be a sustainable market. And I think this is really the core interest of any stakeholder operating this market. Same for ourselves. So, but this should not actually lead to confusing clients and pushing them basically to seek expert opinions on clauses in a given policy. I think that is actually taking it a little too far.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of directions we could take that, but I guess in the interest of time, we'll close out kind of the thought leadership. I do like to ask a few more questions.
Sure.
I think it's interesting to find out people's backgrounds and how they ended up in insurance. So how did you end up in the insurance industry?
A lot of people say by mistake. For me, it was not a mistake. My background is I studied law, and in preparation for the bar exam in Germany, you have to go through a period at that time of 3 years where you actually go through certain stages, and you spend, I don't know, 3 months or 4 months with a state attorney, and then you spend 6 months with a judge and so forth. Right? I went through that phase and looked at each and every single job, and I couldn't see myself in any one of these jobs. I was simply not the typical lawyer.
Okay.
And for me, it was clear that I would actually need to find something outside of that typical job as being a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So I then actually spent time in a law firm in Atlanta in the US for 3 months. And this law firm was specialized on D&O litigation.
Okay.
And this is how I actually ended up in insurance, because I really liked that. That worked so much. It was super interesting. I was involved in a big, you know, settlement negotiations, and we had like, I don't know, five days in a week where we negotiated until 2-3 o'clock at night and so forth. And the next morning, 7 o'clock, we had to be there again, and the negotiations proceeded. And it was so interesting that I said, when I came back to Germany, I said, you know, listen, I really would like to do something with, you know. And that was a very, very small environment at the time. There were only two carriers out there in the market which actually write that. None of them were German. It was AIG and Chubb. And so AIG was looking for D&O underwriters. And this is how I got into insurance. So you can actually say by design, not really. But it was definitely not. I didn't. It was not just by chance. It's there was a decision behind that. And then I went through all the ranks, right? I started as a junior underwriter, then senior underwriter, and then so forth, and went through the ranks. And I believe this is really helpful, because when you then end up in the board, right, you know exactly how that underwriter operates and how that underwriter looks at things. And you know exactly how policies are issued. You know exactly how accounts are actually booked and how premium is processed and so forth, right? You know the details. And that is super important when you sit on the board, because it buys you an awful lot of credibility when you actually have these discussions. When you change things, when you maybe go through a digital transformation and so forth. And it is these conversations with employees and your staff is much more natural and more authentic, because you've been sitting in that seat before a few years back, right? But you know exactly what these people do, and you know exactly how things must come together in order to actually have one slick operation from sales to underwriting to operations to claims and so forth. I'm very grateful for that. It's been a fantastic career, and I really enjoyed that.
And so I guess following that then, what would you recommend to anyone who wants to have a successful career in insurance?
Funny enough, a lot of people ask me that question, and I have mentored a lot of people in the past and still do that. And from my experience, right, you got to be an expert in one area.
Okay.
You don't have to stay in that area for your entire life. A lot of people then stay in that area and they're super happy. Some people are trying to get out of that area and they never manage to do that. But you know, my expertise really was commercial D&O, and here companies in Germany, listed companies, which were seeking a dual listing in the States. So it was actually that was actually my level of expertise and specialism. Why do I say it's important to actually have one special specialty? It buys you a lot of credibility to move from that space into other spaces. And quite honestly, if you are an underwriting expert in one field, you can take this, what you learned, into any other line of business. Yes, they are different. Yes, there are different exposures. And yes, there's a huge difference between long-term and short-term. I know all of this, right?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, what you do is you enrich a new underwriting area with completely different questions. Give you an example, right? Sometime in my career, I had to make a decision on the global head of property line of business. And everybody was expecting, oh, there's this deputy, he will make it, right? Oh, there's this person, oh, he will make it. There's this rumor mill starting in an organization. I didn't do all of this. I took a financial institution D&O underwriter and made that person become the global head of property. That person didn't have any clue about property.
Yeah.
But I knew that person, that she had the will and the ability to really dig very deep holes and to learn super quick and ask completely different questions property underwriters would never look into. And I can tell you it had a huge impact how property underwriters from that day would be looking into BI exposures, as an example.
Yeah.
Nobody looked into the finances of underlying companies or third-party providers and so forth. Nobody ever looked into that. And that changed from that moment on. So, and I really believe that you should take more of the expertise, given expertise in one line of business and make that fluid to other lines of businesses. It would also make people, make the underwriters to look at each other and come together as a team before, right? Long-term, short-term underwriters, they don't really talk to each other in some entities, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you should break that. And there's one mean to break that. But coming back to your initial question, I would really recommend for somebody, pick a topic, become an expert in that topic, and then develop from there. Be open to new things and try to take what you've learned in your expert area and bring that into other areas of the business. It doesn't have to be underwriting. In my case, it was underwriting. I'd always try to get out of underwriting. I never managed to do that, only to the very end of my career. But it is be open, be curious, and trust in yourself and your expertise. And if you don't actually have one area of expertise, it's very difficult, I think, to gain the respect of people you work with. And that is that is crucial. And I say that because I once was transferred or was given the opportunity to leave Germany and then work in the London market. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, being German, I didn't work for a German company. I worked for a US company. Nobody in the London market waits for a German to head up a significant team in London, at least in these days.
Yeah.
And I don't know, might be different today, but that therefore, right, you have to gain the respect of the people who work for you.
Yeah.
And if you're not able to gain that respect, then you will be back in Germany very soon. Uh-huh. And I think this is actually one learning lesson coming out of that as well. So really be curious and from this area of expertise, you can develop in any other direction, and you always have a home base to live off.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you've got me thinking about, where's everybody from in the London market? I mean, obviously mostly people from here, but it's interesting.
It's all English spoken territories. It's all New Zealand. It's Australia. It's Canada. It's the US. Yeah. If foreigners, right? Very few foreigners actually. So there's a lot of people from London, in fact. Mm-hmm. And very, very few people from non-English spoken territories make a career in London. Again, right, for a foreign insurer.
Yep, that's interesting. Well, it was great chatting with you. Really enjoyed hearing your thoughts and experiences. Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Yes, thank you. It was really fun. Really enjoyed it as well.
If you want to learn more about our host Anthony or his company Aceris, visit aceris.com. aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.